So from last class, we introduced this definition of apparent horizon as the outermost marginally outer trapped surface. And we defined this marginally outer trapped surface by looking at the outward null expansion, which is this quantity here, and saying that a marginally outer trapped surface is where this equals zero. So in particular, sort of the intuitive way to think of this as, you know, you're on the surface of your surface, and you take a flashlight, you send out null rays outward, and then you see if those null rays expand or contract. And if they contract, you know, you're inside the apparent horizon, and if they expand, you're outside the apparent horizon. And where they're kind of marginal, that's where the apparent horizon is. And we introduced this definition of the apparent horizon. Part of the motivation was this is a quantity that we can define just on a given time slice, as opposed to the event horizon, in which we sort of need to know the whole future of our space-time and then kind of look at all the null rays that escape to future null infinity and then integrate those backwards and see which ones could have originated outside the event horizon. I also mentioned that sometimes people have looked at additional requirements. So this L plus is the outward one. Another requirement sometimes that people explicitly make, and that's usually true, is that the inward one be negative. You know, you can see if we just have a sphere in flat space, or we can basically get rid of these terms. That'll just be the unit normal in the radial direction. And that'll be, you know, positive for outward one and negative for the inward one. Right. So I should mention that, you know, because this is defined with respect to a particular time slicing, you know, it is possible to sort of construct pathological time slices, for example, even of Schwarzschild, where you don't have apparent horizons. So in some sense, that is somewhat coordinate dependent, but usually that's not the case. And basically, if you find an apparent horizon, then it's going to be, you know, given some reasonable conditions on the matter and cosmic censorship, then it's going to be inside an event horizon and asymptotically flat space-time. So if we go back to our example we mentioned yesterday, where we imagine we have some collapsing shell of matter, and, you know, we look at scribe plus future null infinity, we track all the null rays back, and then we determine where the event horizon is. We mentioned that, you know, the event horizon actually starts here, which sort of corresponds to null rays that can start going outward. They're fine, space-time isn't strongly curved yet, but at some time later they'll meet this collapsing shell of matter, and then they'll sort of be stuck inside the black hole and they can't go anywhere. In contrast, the apparent horizon is going to basically, you know, for this, if this if you consider a very thin spherical shell of matter, it's basically going to form when this spherical shell crosses its Schwarzschild radius when r equals 2m. So it looks something like this. And then as the space-time becomes sort of asymptotes to stationary, the apparent horizon always asymptotes towards the event horizon. So it can sort of starts out space-like here and then asymptotes to being null. So you can think of, you know, here are the light rays that can move outward, but they're going to eventually be stuck behind this collapsing shell, and here are the ones that at this given point can't move outward, they have to go inward. Yeah, and so I also mentioned, actually, there's kind of one non-local piece of information, this apparent horizon definition, which is that it's not just any marginally outer trapped surface, it's the outermost one, which means there's not another marginally outer trapped surface that contains it. So to kind of see why that might be something you need to worry about, you can actually consider what happens in a binary black hole merger. So you're gonna have two black holes, eventually to begin with they're far apart and they come and they merge together to make a bigger black hole. So if you look at the if you look at the event horizon for such a space-time, it actually looks like a pair of pants. So you actually have the event horizon, you have one corresponding to one black hole, you have one corresponding to the other black hole, and as they merge, they're sort of joined together. And then settle down to the event horizon of the final black hole. In contrast, so if we just consider apparent horizons on some time slice, so let's say we sort of consider some time before they merge, we have, apparent horizon one here, apparent horizon two here, then what you actually find is that at some time when they form a common horizon, this sort of common marginally outer trapped surface will just appear and actually contain the original two Motzes. So you actually have all three of these will be marginally outer trapped surfaces, but this one will be the common apparent horizon. And yeah, as I alluded to earlier, basically assuming cosmic censorship and the null energy condition, any trapped surface should always be inside the black hole event horizon. And here by trapped surface, I mean one where, well, there's kind of, I mean one where if you take that surface and compute the outward null expansion, it's negative. So any questions about apparent horizons?
Out of curiosity, what would a black hole merger look like on the Penrose diagram?
It's kind of hard to draw that one, to be honest. it's kind of the limitations of having trying to suppress all the angular information. Good question, though. Any other questions? Okay, so the next topic we're going to discuss for a few lectures is gravitational waves. So there's some references in the syllabus, and I actually found one additional reference in case you don't have any of the textbooks, which I'll mention. Which is this reference by Flanagan and Hughes. You can find that on the archive. All right, so I'm going to begin by discussing basically linear perturbations around some background solution and what the Einstein equations say about those linear perturbations. So I'm actually going to do that maybe you've seen that before, but I'm going to do a slightly more general case where, to begin with, we'll consider an arbitrary Ricci flat background and work out the perturbation equations for that. And then after that, we'll specialize to considering a flat background either with some, either in vacuum, which will be correspond to how gravitational waves propagate in the wave zone, as well as to considering some weak matter sources. And then we'll talk about how they can generate gravitational waves through this matter. And then we'll also discuss how to compute or how to associate energy and angular momentum to the gravitational waves. Yeah, so to begin with, we're going to work out some linear perturbation theory. Okay, so we're going to write our metric as GAB equals GAB hat plus HAB. And so here, GAB is going to be our background solution, and we're going to assume it's a solution to the vacuum Einstein equations. If we compute just the Ricci tensor with respect to this hatted metric, we just get zero. And I'll use this hat basically throughout to denote quantities we compute just with the background metric. And then H is our small perturbation, and we'll only keep up to linear terms in H in all our expressions. And so we're assuming that's small compared to our background solution. First thing we want to compute is the inverse metric. So if we perturb the inverse metric, we get this with the minus sign. And here by H, I'm basically denoting taking our metric perturbation and raising it with respect to the background metric. And again, all these equalities are to linear order in H. All right, so next up, we want to compute the Christoffel symbols with respect to this metric. So we get the Christoffel metric of the background metric, and then we'll basically get two terms. The first one, we have the background metric here, and then we have derivatives of the perturbation. Uh, And then the second term basically replace this one with the metric perturbation, and then replace these guys with the background metric. The second term we can recognize is just basically if we take the background Christoffel symbol and lower this index here. So that means we can write delta of the Christoffel symbol, by which I just mean the Christoffel symbol minus the background one. Is equal to this quantity, where I'm just now replacing these partials with now the covariant derivative of both the background, respect to the background metric. And we'll use that later, so we'll call it star. And we could have sort of also derived this in kind of a simpler way by just saying, let's compute this at a point, and let's choose coordinates in the vicinity of that point such that the background Christoffel symbols vanish, right? Because we always had that freedom to kind of make the metric, the first derivative of the metric vanish. So in that case, we wouldn't get the second term, we just get this this first term. But then these partial derivatives would be the same as the covariant derivatives in local coordinates. So then we could rewrite our expression like this, and then now it's in a covariant form. And so then now we can drop the condition that we're just considering things at a point in those special coordinates. So I also want to note in passing that if we just contract these two indices with the background metric, then we get this. We're here by H, I'm denoting basically the trace of the metric perturbation. And this is kind of almost the source functions we talked about when we talked about the harmonic gauge last class. So this is basically minus the box of the coordinates, but box with respect to the background. So technically that's the the full box, but then you pick up this extra term. But you notice in particular that if we're considering some flat metric, actually the the box of the coordinate, if we're perturbing a flat metric, this box of the coordinates is just equal to this. So we'll come back to that in just a second. All right, so we have the Christoffel symbols. So now we're ready to calculate the perturbed Riemann metric. So refresh your memory, the general expression for the Riemann tensor is this, in terms of derivatives of the Christoffel symbols. So there's the general expression. We're going to basically do this trick I mentioned we could have done up there to make this computation easier. We're going to consider we're computing the Riemann tensor at a point. We're going to choose coordinates in the vicinity of that point where the Christoffel symbols of the background metric disappear, and so the background covariant derivative is the same as just the partial derivative. So in those coordinates, we get the following. Okay, and basically now to generalize this to a covariant expression, we just do the following. So this expression is just the Riemann tensor for the background solution, because you can see this is the same as this in a frame where these vanish. And then for these guys, you basically just need to change these to covariant derivatives. Okay. So now things are getting a little bit messy because we want to plug in this expression for the perturbation of the Christoffel symbol into here and sort of turn the crank. Hopefully, I didn't make too many index errors. Yeah, so all we did was plug that expression in here. And here, again, by delta, I just mean this minus that. OK. And then now we want to contract this to get the, basically contract A with C, and then it'll give us the Ricci tensor, the perturbation to the Ricci tensor. Here again, H is just as I defined it there, the trace. All right. Yeah, so then we're almost done. Basically, the final steps are to you can contract this again, get the perturbed Ricci scalar, and then calculate the perturbation to the Einstein tensor. And you know, here we're allowing some matter, but we're considering TAB to kind of be perturbative because we are requiring that the background Ricci tensor be zero. Okay, so yeah, so I'm gonna kind of skip the last part of the math here, but basically, yeah, all you have to do is contract this. And then plug in these expressions here from there. I'm going to kind of rewrite the expressions in a simpler form using what's called the trace reverse metric perturbation. So that's this quantity here with the bar. You can see that it basically has the same information as the metric perturbation. But if I take its trace, or I get h, here I'm going to get h minus 2h. So the trace of this has the opposite trace as the metric perturbation itself. So for that reason, it's usually referred to as the trace reversed metric perturbation. So writing this out in terms of H bar, we get the following. Okay, so skip some algebra there, but yeah, basically using this definition, and we also to arrived at this basically commuted some covariant derivatives. Yeah, I basically commuted some covariant derivatives. Let's see. Oh no, sorry, that's right. We commuted some covariant derivatives such that, as you'll notice now in these expressions, you always have one of the indices of the H's contracted with the sort of inner covariant derivative, and that'll be important in a second. But you know, since these covariant derivatives don't actually, you can't just switch them in a flat space time. That's how we picked up this extra Riemann tensor term. Right. So so far, we haven't picked a gauge. Right. You know, just as in the generalized harmonic formulation. To get some evolution equations, we have to pick a gauge. Here we have to pick a gauge as well. As basically I just alluded to, we can basically make our lives a lot simpler if we basically choose the condition. Basically the covariant derivative of H is zero. So this is sometimes called Lorentz gauge. And that's just with, you know, analogy with electromagnetism, where you choose that the covariant derivative of the vector potential vanish. So you notice if we choose this, all these terms go to zero. So we're just left with our wave operator and this extra curvature term. And you also notice from this expression here, that's actually just this is actually just the trace reversed HAB. Choosing this to be zero is basically saying that this box with respect to the background of the coordinate doesn't change when we perturb our metric. So it's kind of related to the harmonic gauge. And in fact, in flat space, it is just the harmonic gauge. Okay, so just when the dust clears, we have this nice expression. So here we've kind of chosen some of our gauge degrees of freedom, but we actually have some freedom left. So to see that, let's consider a small coordinate transformation. We need it to be small, basically, because we don't want to change coordinates too much so that our background solution in these new coordinates is kind of non-linearly different from the one we had originally. So let's say xa goes, some coordinates xa goes to xa prime. Try it as xa plus z of a. This is some, in general, it's a function of the space-time coordinates. But again, it has to be small. And then under that transformation, our metric perturbation transforms like this. And just by taking the covariant, sorry. And just applying a covariant derivative to this expression. We get the following. So we can see in general, if we start out with a metric perturbation in some arbitrary coordinates, let's say they're if we start out in these unprime coordinates and it's some arbitrary metric perturbation, we can basically solve for we can basically solve the wave equation for our coordinate transformation C with some source that's just the covariant derivative of that metric perturbation. And then once we have the solution CI, we can transform to these prime coordinates. And then if this equals mine right if this equals minus that, then this will be zero, right? So we can always transform to this Lorentz gauge, but in some sense we have a little bit of extra freedom because we just have to find some solution to this wave equation, but we basically still get to choose initial data for C. In particular, for the wave equation, we can choose C at t equals zero, for example, and its first derivative, first time derivative at t equals zero, or said another way, if we have a solution that satisfies the Lorentz condition, so that this is so that this is zero to begin with, we can always add an additional coordinate transformation C as long as that C satisfies the wave equation, and we still have the freedom to choose initial data for what C is, and then its evolution would be determined by the wave equation without a source. So originally, our gauge freedom was this full diffeomorphism choice where we can basically choose four functions of our space-time coordinates, right? But now with Lorentz gauge, we can basically choose these coordinates at t equals zero, this coordinate transformation, and its time derivative. So basically, we can choose these eight functions, but just on one Cauchy surface. Okay, and one final thing to note is that if we just take the trace of this, then this one's going to go to zero because of the anti-symmetry of those indices. And we get basically a wave equation for the trace. So we're going to sort of specialize to several different particular cases in the following. And sort of those will motivate different choices for these residual gauge freedoms. One thing we want to be considered to begin with is just to choose vacuum space times, that is, set the stress energy tensor to zero. So in that case, the trace of the of h bar, which is just minus the h, just satisfies a wave equation without any source. So basically, we can use this residual gauge freedom to set the metric perturbation in its first time derivative to zero, and then it'll be zero for all times. And so in that case, there's no difference between this trace reversed and the original metric perturbation. So if we specialize even further to not only vacuum, but also a flat background, so that's just the Minkowski metric for G hat. So this will be basically what we want to do in the wave zone. We're considering the propagation of gravitational waves. Then we can actually set H of T A, so all the components that have one time component to zero. So we'll notice that in flat space, we drop this term, and in vacuum, we drop this term. So basically, each metric component sort of satisfies a wave equation by itself. So if we set one to zero and its time derivative to zero, then it'll be zero for all time. And we'll go through the details of why we can do this in a second, but in that case, you can actually just choose that all the time components are zero for all time. So if we choose vacuum, but we don't choose a flat background, instead we choose a Kerr black hole, then we're in the regime of black hole perturbation theory. In that case, you can't necessarily set this condition, which is sometimes called the transverse condition, because of the extra curvature terms. But we'll hopefully talk a little bit about black hole perturbation theory next week. And then the third case we're going to consider is, instead of having vacuum, we have some matter, but we're still perturbing around flat space. So we'll talk about this for generating gravitational waves. But again, here you can actually ensure that the trace is zero for all time, basically because even if it's initially zero, it could pick up some evolution equation according to your stress energy tensor. And same thing for these time components. Yeah, so any questions about that before we start talking about the propagation of gravitational waves? Okay. Yeah, so we're going to specialize to this case 1A, so vacuum and the flat background. Vacuum and the flat background. We're going to basically choose, we're going to choose traceless, the traceless condition. We're going to choose that all the time components are zero. So that might look like it's kind of over-determining things. Because basically this is kind of four, and then another one is five, but we can show that we basically get one of these for free using just the Lorentz condition. So the Lorentz condition and just in flat space is that this is zero. So this tells us that in particular, for the TT component, we have the following. So if we, and there's a T here. If we just choose that the TI components are zero, then this term will be zero. The TT component will be constant. And then we might as well choose that to zero. It's a non-radiative degree of freedom. Yeah, we're left with just these space-space components of this traceless metric perturbation. And so people usually write TT to indicate it's transverse and traceless. And then our equation is just, the flat wave operator on this equals zero. And so we know that we can solve this basically using plane wave solutions. These are plane waves. Here's just some constant amplitude. And here Ka is also some constant wave vector. So to determine the conditions on Ka, we can plug in this ansatz to our wave equation, and we get the following. So we can see that since this needs to equal zero for a general solution, we really just want this to vanish, which is the same as saying that this four vector K is a null vector. And of course, that makes sense because we know that gravitational waves should sort of propagate the speed of light. Yeah, and let's recall that our Lorentz condition in this is simplified in our TT gauge to be the following. So basically, that says that we want this component in the direction of the propagation to be zero. So let's consider a plane wave moving in the z direction. So choose Ka to just have a time component and a component in the z direction. And you notice this is null in flat space. Do the same. And then that allows us to write this Aij matrix here. So for the Lorentz condition, all the z components should be zero. And then we know the trace has to be zero as well. That's why we have this is minus that. And we also know there has to be a symmetric matrix. So this kind of shows you how you get two polarizations corresponding to the physical degrees of the gravitational wave. Okay. And to sort of see how a propagating gravitational wave would affect sort of proper lengths, we can consider two geodesics in this TT gauge. So we're going to consider geodesic A. That just sits at the origin for all time, and geodesic B. That sits at some x, some coordinate separation L. So you can check that those are actually geodesics for this metric perturbation. And then if we want to calculate the proper distance between A and B, we'll get the following. So it's proper distance squared. So basically, for this 2 points separated in the x-axis, their proper distance is going to oscillate. That's going to be L, but then we'll have this basically cosine correction that will oscillate the frequency of the gravitational wave. And for this x-axis separation, that'll correspond to the amplitude of h plus. And if we do the same thing with you can kind of rotate it by 45 degrees, we'll get the h cross. So just to remind you, these sort of the h plus polarization sort of corresponds to if you have like a circle of freely following sort of inertial observers, and you have a gravitational wave propagating to the board, it'll sort of go like this, and then back, and then this. Whereas if you have this h cross polarization, I'll sort of do this rotated by 45 degrees, so like this, and then this. And then finally, we can note that if we rotate, if we basically consider rotations about this z-axis, the direction of propagation, by some angle phi, we get the following. Place to write that. So rotating by an angle phi around the z-axis, this sort of complex number which encodes both polarizations, basically just picks up this extra phase. This corresponds to 2 phi. And that's why we usually refer to these gravitational waves as being spin 2, or another way of saying that they're spin 2 because they're their tensor perturbations. Okay, so I think that's a good place to end for today. And next time we'll talk about the generation of gravitational waves in the weak field. So any questions about this? All right, well, I'll stick around for a couple minutes.